right. We're recording. This is episode 8 of season 15 of Mention and Dispatches. We have two guests on the show tonight that we've never had with Mention and Dispatches before, but there's a reason for it, and you will know them both from their wargaming credentials, but we're only here sort of to talk about wargaming a bit. We'll explain all here in just a second. So first of all, Wes Crawford is here from the, look, I know it's Warfrat Publishing, Warfrat Games. I keep calling you guys collectively the Warfrats.
That's good.
That's just sort of how I refer to you and Ryan.
Ryan Heilman and myself, and then we still design for other people too, but we're excited about what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah. Whenever we start talking about you guys, like around the Origins programming and stuff, it's like, yeah, okay, we're going to have the Warfrats on that table. It just, yep. That's who you guys have become. Sorry. And then Dan Bullock is here also. Dan's been on a variety of shows and such before, but also a designer as well. So welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you being here. And so the reason these guys are here, while their wargaming cred is important, they are also both professional musicians. Wes on the drums and Dan on damn near everything else. Although some drums too, I think. So, and look, folks that have listened to the podcast for a while know that I've been on the fringes of the music business for a number of years, although not lately, and never to the degree that either of these two gentlemen have been. My radio days are way in the past, and thankfully my performing days are too, because I don't need to be on a stage anymore. But we brought these guys in some number of years ago when we had Rocky and someone else on a podcast together, and we had a conversation around it wasn't intended to start that way, but we ended up with a conversation around how some of the game business and game industry today, and wargaming is a subset of it, feels similar to where the music business was 40, 50 years ago, in that you're starting to see big conglomerates really start to rise and take over. You're starting to see a lot more segmentation of audiences and a lot more micro-targeting of very specific niches and marketing into those very specific niches. You still have a thriving indie scene, but it is harder and harder for them to break through as more and more things get hoovered up by the bigger organizations. You still have some kind of loose legal agreements and some legal patterns and processes that are only starting to get regularly codified. You're still seeing a lot of imitators. You're still seeing a lot of people hopping on bandwagon trends. And it's almost, there are times where the music business today almost feels like you could be making the movie Almost Famous today about the game business, kind of to where the music business was at the time that movie was being made. And so this went a little deeper than I'm summarizing right here, but on just first impressions from that, Dan, how crazy am I with this whole idea?
There's a lot of similarities, I think. That's half of why I got into game design, is some of these similarities, and half of what frightens me about the game industry current state is the amount of overlap, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. Wes, how about from your seat and the things that you have seen?
Oh, yeah. I've said this just offhand to people a lot, that the industries are very similar in that you have this artistic component and you're trying to get known and seen. And so you have to sign with somebody, you know, typically. I mean, there's a lot of do-it-yourself people, too. But especially coming from my era, I still do it for a living. I teach a lot and perform about 5 or 10 different bands right in the D.C., Baltimore area. I'll be down in South Carolina this weekend, this kind of stuff. But back in the 80s, when I was actually touring, it was a really, compared to now, it was a great time to be in the music industry, because there's so many places where be hotels, resorts, things like that. You'd play maybe 6 nights a week, but you'd be just set up there. And, you know, the college circuit was going really big and so many things like that. But yeah, the whole idea of you come up with your music or stylized music, if you know you're doing covers, and then you have to have somebody in the biz to sort of connect with to make you more famous, to produce the actual product, the recording versus the actual game. It was very, very similar in the way you go about marketing is, yeah, you want to target who it is you're trying to appeal to, and you know, go from there. And it's changed changed with everything online a lot. I often say that I'm glad I'm not young coming right out of college and deciding to be a musician now. I think it's really would be much harder to really get traction and you know, pretty much you get online and try to market yourself that way so that people will come out and see you play live, and then you'll, you know, make money. But the whole selling albums and stuff has changed so much too. But just from my point of view, just individual playing drums, I play with a lot of different musicians. What do I do now that I have my own product? I try to hook up. I found out conventions are great. Conventions are great in the music industry too for making connections. But I found it's like crucial, you know, in this gaming industry. And that's how it worked for me. I have 5 games under contract, 2 are out, and a few other things are coming up. And, you know, that's where it starts snowballing if you go there. And I think because I'm not afraid to go out and meet people and just, you know, lay myself bare, because you get so much rejection in the music industry too. If we're in the arts, I always tell people, all right, for every 10 opportunities, if you 2 come through, you're like really lucky and doing great. And it can be the same way with, you can get a lot of rejection in the game industry too. So I just think there's so many parallels.
Dan, I know you've got a couple of designs under your belt, as well as, you know, your time spent on tour and in the, what's Wes mentioned, the rejection rate. What's been your experience with the rejection rate, kind of comparing your musical rejection rate to your game design rejection rate? How close are they?
I'm glad you asked, Brian. I really want to dwell on rejection right now. I would say that the rejection rate in the games industry is higher from my experience. Yeah. Because there's a lot more of an established avenue of do it yourself within music, making your own records, kind of your way, being able to distribute your own stuff, can establish your own, you know, kind of circuit, book your own tours and things like that. With games, it's been like, I started designing in 2016, and I realized basically in the past 8-9 years, like, you basically have to learn how to do everything. Like, you need to be able to have some idea of like how to do your own graphic design, how to network with people to meet the rest of your team, like who is going to be developing your work, who could potentially be publishing it, who else might you co-design with, who are the content creators that are going to cover it. And it's not very schmoozy. It's very practical, like in terms of like Ocean's 11, I'm going to build a freaking team. We're going to pull a heist. I got to get the game made. And I think with a band, sometimes it feels a little bit more like I was the band leader. So I'm writing stuff and then I'm trying to recruit people to play it. And that felt a little bit more like, you know, you're trying to start Jonestown or something. It just seems like really like kind of like a ridiculous undertaking, and something that could be off-putting to all but about 3 or 4 people that you've hoodwinked into like joining you on that adventure. But similarly, I just think that for me, the rejection experience is a little different, because I felt like I made a very peculiar kind of music. It was sort of out in its own space, and eventually, being apart from everything else, your audience will find you. They'll kind of market over there. And it didn't, like, within 10 years, I think attracted like a decent size enough audience. It was just that the wear and tear of that much travel, wanting to be sedentary, wanting to progress the part of my career that was actually making money, you know, wanting to have like a house and things like that, just, you know, stressing everybody around me out. And I knew like a lot of brilliant musicians that hadn't gone to the dentist in 8 years, couldn't afford to go to a therapist, stuff like that. It's just like a huge problem, like in the community of physicians or of musicians, like where it's just like people don't necessarily have insurance. They aren't really well protected. They don't have retirement, none of that stuff. So some of it was practicality, but the idea that I could carry my weird kind of art making kind of, you know, mindset into game design. And it was a matter of like, well, how far can you stand apart here and make your own thing? And it seemed harder in game design in general, because I think that there's so much pressure by publishers to kind of create similar things that have already hit or that other people are doing. And if kind of how I how you as a designer know when you're on the right track happens to be when you are doing something unique and your feet aren't quite touching the bottom of, you know what I mean, like whatever waters you're swimming in. I think that that's a really tough place to be, because the industry is telling you one thing when you know artistically you kind of have to go and do the other.
Yeah. See, what you have done, Dan, with games, I could feel like I could sort of know what you were trying to do with music. Because you do take interesting topics and interesting mechanics to represent them. I mean, I'm a big fan of yours. And I really like that. You know, I sometimes say, I want to be Dan Bullock when I grow up. But even though I'm a generation past you. But yeah, it's really cool. But it connects in that way, too. Now, I think, I used to design games when I was in high school and middle school and even college. And then I got out of it when I said, all right, I got to be serious about music. And I toured for 10 years with this fantastic jazz R&B singer and all this stuff before I got married and we settled into the D.C. Baltimore area. And then I freelanced. But through the years, I did start making some game-like educational materials for music, because I also teach. You know, I teach. I have about 30 students now, and that's, I used to have 50, but I'm where I want to be. But I did come up with the rap-along game. Mm-hmm. It's modeling with tongue-in-cheek the sort of industry. You know, you go around and you try to get all the things you need, like your gold chains and your posses and all that. And then if you get an opportunity, if you have the right things, you get a chance to rap, and you pick a word card and roll a die, and then you hit the play button, and there's a little track that comes along. You have to come up with a rhyme. You know, I haven't signed that one yet. But anyway, that and just a few other things. I have the drum set play along DVD I did. This was back in around 2000. And it's with a green screen. It's some pretty famous musicians playing a band. And it's what you see is from over the drum set. So it's for drummers to play along with a band. And it's a storyline. They start out, you know, you're auditioning with all these scowling drummers watching you. And finally you get on stage and the Doobie Brothers concert in Roanoke, Virginia, they allowed me to film the audience from the stage. Wow. And so from there, I went to, certainly you have this in your collection, a Rhythmic Murder Mystery DVD. And I had a live show of this, and I did that at a lot of camps and things for, you know, teenagers. And it's a murder mystery, a masterpiece theater gone wrong murder mystery, where the narrator will outline what's happening and then comes upon a multiple choice question, like what time did the murder take place? Was it 5, 7, or 9? Listen to the next piece, which I played on electronic drums, and is it in 5, 7, or 9? And so it's these double entendres throughout, you know, connecting music and murder. And, you know, if you don't have one and you really want one, I'll send you one. But
but I'm just thinking the whole connecting music and murder, like you're doing it with a game for fun, and there's people that like are actually connecting music with murder, you know.
So what I was doing was I was frustrated this whole time, because I was doing the music and I love it and I still love it today and every day, you know, is fantastic. But I was missing that game thing. So that's why around 2018, I started saying, you know, wow, I'd really like to try some of those games like I used to make, you know, back in the day. And those were Hex Encounter. But I started seeing what everybody was doing and said, wow, one of the first games I bought to look at things was Whitechapel. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you mean it's just a regular occurrence in a game that one player can go out viciously murdering innocent women? I mean, are there no boundaries anymore? You know, and so I guess that stimulated me to start designing, and then going to conventions, and things worked out, you know, better.
Wes, was it the play experience for Letters from Whitechapel, or the lack of boundaries in Letters from Whitechapel that inspired you?
Exactly. Yeah, sort of. I mean, it was like, because I always like, my first Avalon Hill game was Midway. So I like hidden movement and that kind of, you know, of a game. So I think I saw that and said, well, let me see what they're doing with hidden movement now, you know. And so that's sort of how I ran across that one. But you know, that's just, you know, my history of how I came to connect these two things.
It's such an overt way to incorporate music in design. like those designs you were describing?
Because it was fun.
I just find it like really hard to get away from it.
Yeah, I did try to shop those around. And, you know, the wrap along actually, when it was just a CD to practice with and stuff, that sold a fair amount. The play along DVD, which educational tool to play along, and you had, you know, sheet music you could print out and stuff. That sold a lot, and it was interesting where it did. I sold it music, you know, people like that. And when I say a lot, I say probably about 1,000 or something, you know, so not tremendous on my own. But libraries, public libraries. And somebody told me, said, who's a singer and did children's music, and said, there are three journals at the time. They were, you know, hardcover journals. And that if you can get them to review you, you'll get all kinds of sales. And I sent it to all three, and two did. And so all of a sudden I'm getting like Canada, we need 50 copies. And, you know, all these different counties that want it in every library, you know, or school libraries, things like that. So that's another thing that I think has helped me a little bit. Getting into games is realizing, you know, product placement is a big thing, you know, that I don't think we really do enough with either. Now, we're just designers. We don't have our own company necessarily, but I think games could be sold at a lot more places than they are too, you know.
You were describing the play along DVD for the drum. I'm trying to figure out how you never ended up as a consultant on one of the Rock Band games.
Oh, well, yeah. And I saw all that taking, you know, place around me and stuff.
Yeah.
And Rock Band came after.
Absolutely.
After what I did, of course, you know, that's how things work. Yeah.
Hey, this guy made this thing work on a DVD. Why don't we get him to come help out with this whole Rock Band thing?
Okay. So. I don't think I can get in any trouble saying this. I was just, 2 weeks ago, I was accompanying my wife to Minneapolis, St. Paul, because she had a convention she was going to. And I called up Liz Davidson. She was like, so cool. And invited me to come see Leader Games headquarters, and we went out for lunch and stuff. And I went in the headquarters, and they had this one room with some tables set up with different games and all that. And there in the corner was Rock Band. And so they get tired of what they're doing, I guess, you know, the employees, the people work there, they go down and play Rock Band. I thought that was pretty funny, you know.
We used to, when I was working for a defense contractor, we had the conference rooms with the giant widescreen TVs. Mm-hmm. Every now and then after work, 2-3 times a month, a couple of folks would bring in their Xboxes. And we'd get some big Team Halo games going through the entire building. We'd have one team in one conference room, another team in another conference room, and then a third team out in the big foyer area with a projector with theirs, with their Xbox hooked up. And we'd have the phones in all of the conference rooms on intercom where we were yelling at each other, talking smack across the building. Big four play. I mean, we had 12 people going in one Halo game. It was kind of like, you know, the modern version of the old LAN party. Yeah, when you needed that decompression, we'd go blow each other up playing Halo. Dan, you were about to jump in there with something.
No, I didn't have anything like that. I was always holding out for like Activision to make an accordion hero, you know, just a controller with the Stradella bass side of an accordion with 120 small tiny buttons. In an indentation in two of them, so you could orient your way around home row.
Yeah, but you'd have like two Billy Joel songs and then like 17 Weird Al songs in the base game, right? I mean, that's what you'd end up with.
I mean, that ratio is close to tolerable, but I think we could find other stuff.
Well, remember, you got to sell it to the mass audience somehow, right?
Yeah, maybe someday might be Giants and a couple of Los Lobos covers or something.
Yeah, there you go. You could sneak some They Might Be Giants in there. So in terms of, you know, you guys definitely saw it on the music industry side. I played a handful of low-level club gigs here and there, but I saw it more on the radio side and the production side because that's where I was when I was, you know, on the edges of the music business. But you guys also saw it on the recording and publication and touring side and the, you know, a little more on the performer side of things. The way in which the industry is structured in terms of you have the smaller indie niche kinds of studios versus the big mass market studios that are trying to have big broad appeal. That big broad appeal sometimes comes with deep pockets that allow you to sort of boss a little bit of the industry around, but it also comes with a need to continually feed those deep pockets. And that if you're not a surefire million selling, you know, music artist, you're probably not going to get a lot of attention from those labels. Similarly, if you're not one of those surefire, you know, 100,000 or more unit selling game designers, you're probably not going to get a lot of attention from those big guys. Is this terribly off base, or is there actually some similarity in the way those things are structured? I mean, Dan, you spent a bunch of years on the road, but you were also, you know, wrangling with some labels and having to put some things out yourself. How would you modify that comparison?
I mean, I put out everything of mine by myself.
Yeah.
And I played on other people's records where they were working with labels. So that was my ability to see what they were experiencing. And it was a great way to better appreciate my own situation. It's kind of like when you're a kid and you're asked to do yard work, you'll find the laziest, crappiest way of doing it that takes the least effort. And that's how labels tend to market things.
Yeah.
I think the reason they want it to be similar to other things on their roster, maybe not on their roster, but like an air up is looking for something that's similar, that's already successful, is because then they can do the, it sounds like this and this, and market it in this very lazy way, instead of having to forge a way to figure out how to market, I don't know, instead of being like Asylum Records trying to market Tom Waits or something. And yeah. Stuff, it's just like, it's more work. And they just don't want to do that work. And it's also, it's not guaranteed that they're going to figure it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
As the marketplace gets crowded, it's actually better to stand out and differentiate yourself. And so it's just like, I think that within our corner of the hobby specifically, we don't have too much mega hits, I would say, that we're being forced to clone over and over again.
Yep.
But there are a lot of Bulge games, and there are a lot of American Civil War games, and there are a lot of samey topics that keep getting covered again. And it's not that they shouldn't be covered, but it's also like, this rich tapestry of history, it's just like a ton of stuff we could be doing that we're not. And yeah. It's mostly like not a lack of imagination on designers' part, in my opinion. It's probably a lack of courage on the part of many publishers. No offense to the War of France. But I find it really interesting that, you know, like one of the difficult things with pitching my first couple of games was that it was North Korea and Iran. For my first
yeah.
Two yep. And it was really tough to get, there was no Whirly Gig or Fort Circle or anybody who wasn't doing just war games in that market space. It was yeah. publishing historical games. And so as a result, I had to convince them that that was a war game, which it was not. And then on top of that, I had to basically try to create their interest despite the fact I knew that my topic wasn't something that was like very like kind of Eurocentric or American centered, where it was going to be easy for them to pitch it to their built in audience.
Yeah.
So as a result, it was just a matter of like, I'm putting a group of people in the foreground that just it's just not centered on them and their experience. Mm-hmm. So when I pitched a North Korea game, it was always like, where's America? Like, I want to see America here.
Yeah.
And when it was Iran, like in, you know, from the, you know, Operation Ajax to the Muslim Revolution, then it was a matter of like, oh, America will be in this, right? And then it was like, no, we have different groups of Iranians. And like, I had a couple publishers say, well, no one's going to be able to tell the difference between these groups of Iranians, because, you yeah. know, basically like no one knows anything about this history. And it's like, well, mm-hmm. that's why I play games.
Yeah, yeah. Here, play this and learn them. You mentioned a lot of the usual topics. The term I've completely ripped off, Cole Worley used it one time on one of the podcast episodes. He calls them the wargaming stations of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You have the Bulge, you have Gettysburg, you have Stalingrad, you have Waterloo. Like there's the normal ones that everybody's going to do and everybody feels the need to have. And but yeah, I've always loved that term.
On social media at one point, like a flow chart for, are you thinking of designing a Bulge game?
Yeah.
Follow this. And it was just, are you John Butterfield?
I have a Bulge game coming out. All no, seriously. And I'll tell you why. All my designs so far are, you know, not have not been done before. Have the engine thieves yeah. about the great mm-hmm. locomotive chase, and that hadn't been done before for some reason, you know. And the other side of the coin is the Confederate raid on St. Albans, Vermont. I've got that game coming out with Compass. It's been turned in. I have another historical fantasy with them, which hasn't been done. You know, I have all these kinds of things. The Pursuit of John Wilkes Booth that did with Ryan mm-hmm. Heilman. Nothing been, you know, done like that. So I came up with a new way to do a war game. And I said, what does it make sense to do to test this out to see if it's really different and unique? And I said, I'm going to put it into the Battle of the Bulge precisely because it's the most over-designed yeah. subject in the world. So I played it with a few people and I'm getting the reaction I wanted from it. That it's, you know, different. It's simultaneous play and with a timer, and you're both moving your units and attacking and all that at the same time. So like Zilla Blitz said, this makes me very anxious. It's very different, but it makes, you know, so, okay, I love that. I want to bring new feelings to experiences of feelings to players. And so that's right now considered to be our second Warfrat game. Of course, yeah. our first one is A Forlorn Hope, which is Herman Luttman's, you know, design of World War One trench warfare. But,
you know, about 2 or 3 years ago, one of the columns that I'd written for the Dragoon site was, why do we need another blank game, right? Fill mm-hmm. in the blank, Waterloo, Gettysburg, whatever, pick one. And so I'm not a big fan of the whole, let's go back over the same things we've done before. I understand the marketing niche behind it, especially for new publishers. They feel the need to, well, you know, you're supposed to have a Waterloo game. Therefore, yeah. we must make a Waterloo game. But I mean, look, when I'm sitting down doing Tuesday Newsday and you know, I add stuff up throughout the week, but then on Tuesday itself is when I pop open the tabs for like all the publishers. And so as I'm finding new publishers, I'm adding them to that rotation and you see it, like everybody wants a Bulge game. Everybody wants the Waterloo game. Everybody wants the Stalingrad game. And so I intentionally tried to argue the contrarian position of, okay, so why would we need so many games on the same topic? And part of it was it allows people to really see kind of the argument you're trying to make with your system. Mm-hmm. I'm not having to learn about the battle. I'm not having to try and figure out that Little Round Top is a key piece of terrain. I'm not having to figure out that, you know, Bastogne is an important crossroads because of how the road network actually works in the Ardennes. I don't have to figure those things out in a battle that I don't know much about, because I already know all of the historical things behind it. I know the key piece of terrain. I know the key units that have to move a certain way. And so instead I can focus on, all right, I know what the history's supposed to do. Show me how your game changes what I'm looking at as a part mm-hmm. of that. Show me how your game models something different or unique or in some other way changes the paradigm. One of the better examples that I'd ever seen of that. It was a bit of a gimmick, but I thought it was making a decent case for understanding how units used to move around the battlefield when keeping people in linear formations was important. Avalanche Press about 20 years ago had a Gettysburg game. It was Gettysburg 1863, I think is what it was called. And it was a Gettysburg game that was all area movement. So all of the, there's no hexes, it's all area stuff, but the pieces are all wide formation pieces. So they're double width and you've got the front facing in order to be able to fire. But as you move your units around the battlefield, the pieces had to physically fit within the space in order to move into there. Mm-hmm. So it gave you a sense of what it was like to have to move and position full formations of units around the battlefield and still maintain facing, which really mattered back then with musket fire. That look, you weren't really going to learn anything new about the battle itself out of this game. Gettysburg is Gettysburg is Gettysburg. We know what that looks like, but it gave you a different appreciation for how you had to actually tactically shuffle people around the battlefield in order to maintain your lines, in order to bring effective fire, in order to not trip over each other. Mm-hmm. And so that was an example of a different mechanic that gave you a new way to look at a game. Now, not saying it was a great game, just that it was a different way to look at it. And so there can be a case for going back to the same material sometimes. I think there's probably more people going back to the same material than should, because I think a lot of them are mediocre cover bands, right? I'm doing the same thing that everybody else has done, just not quite as well. Mm-hmm. Give me something different.
Well, you're stating my exact case for why I did Battle of the Bulge. In fact, I didn't think I wanted to do Battle of the Bulge game. I came out with a system I called Urgent Commands, and then I said, where should I take that system to prove it? And so that's why I did that. So we're saying the same thing there. I have another point I just thought of, sort of you know, parallel between, you know, what sometimes happens in the games and versus what I see musicians doing too. And it's sort of a sort of a word of caution is what I'd like to, you know, spread that I've had, and I bet you might have too, Dan. I've known a number of musicians that were fantastic, and they record their music, they're trying to get a deal, and then once they get offered a deal, if they can't have 100% control of what happens to it, then they won't sign. And I know so much good music that never got heard. I have one friend, I know he's not going to watch this, so I can say it. Manu Kashe wanted to produce his material, you know, and who was the drummer from Sting, who's, you know, done a whole lot. And I mean, he would have been known in the world music circles pretty easily if he let him do this. But then all of a sudden, grabs it back, you know, close to his chest, doesn't want to let it get out. And I'm seeing game designers do that too. And it's like, what? No, the way we have to think of ourselves, and I'd really want to see if you agree, Dan and Brant, is that we have a nice product or something we believe in. All right, this is just a snapshot of what we're doing today. I can't hold it too close to my chest and not let anybody, you know, be a part of it. Let's go with this, you know, publisher or whatever, because I want to get my foot out into the market. I want people to start knowing me, but I have to believe in myself to do this, that I have a lot more that can come out too, you know? And I think if somebody says, this is my opus, nothing's ever going to come out after it, if they have that attitude, then they're going to hold it too close to them and not, you know, share it and let anybody have any control. But that's my attitude, which I think is the better one, is, okay, let me just get it out there. It's a game, you know, I'm not doing this for my living. It'd be nice to make some money, you know, from it, but you know, just get it out there so that I can go to the next thing and all that.
I agree with that somewhat.
Okay.
Like a little bit. I do see the thing where, like, once I always tell designers when they're asking me about a first project, it's like, they're like, what should I start? And they'll mention like three or four ideas. It's like, do the one you can finish. Do the one you know you can finish. Do that first. If you think you could finish all of them, just do the smallest one, because in a year or two, you're going to hate it. So get it in your, you know, get it behind you and then move on to the next thing. And I think that, like, that cradling it and like not letting other people see it, you're delaying it getting the crap kicked out of it. And that's kind of what it needs. But I also understand in my punk rock bones that you really do kind of like some of these ideas. It's like there's, you'll talk to 30 people about, you know, some idea, and a lot of them will tell you how it's not marketable. And then you just don't change anything and you go right to the audience and then it's fine. It's a really good reception.
A lot of bands have done that. You know, look at Snarky Puppy and so many different bands.
Oh, yeah.
Season 15 of Mentioned in Dispatches is graciously supported by all of our Patreon members, but especially our regimental patrons who supported us at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Miles R., James M., Kevin Bertram, Catastrophe Games, Fred and his dog, Joseph Knorr, Patrick Geraghty, Michael Sunborg, Sagar Wing, and Paul LaFontaine. Wargaming is our jam, and they help us spread it. You too can support the Regiment of Strategy Gaming as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Should I tell the story? I think I'm going to name names. I think it's fine because he knows about it. I've told friends about it, but I've never talked about it on the podcast. When I was pitching No Motherland Without, I did take it to GMT's Weekend at the Warehouse and pitch it to G. And he didn't play it. He just kind of let me give a show and tell. He didn't know me from anywhere. Mm-hmm. I had never designed anything. I had never even been a weekend at the warehouse. I live in Milwaukee. There's just like, I was very geographically challenged in that way. So I brought my prototype for No Motherland Without, which looks very similar to the game that eventually gets released by Compass. Years later. But
I have it. It's right behind me.
Excellent. But I showed it to Gene, and he's going through some cards, kind of quizzing me on the topic that I've been researching for a couple of years, which I didn't mind because he doesn't know me again. So yeah, be like, why is this white guy from Wisconsin doing this game about Korea? But he gets to the generation map, which is like a part of my game where there's like human faces And it's to mirror like basically the proximity of citizens to one another, to mirror how kind of like a surveillance can occur within like certain settings, how elite the proximity of elites within the regime to citizens who may be defecting could be an impediment to their travel out of the country for exit. And then it could be marked deceased, imprisoned, all things like that. But they're looking at you in the face every single time you're marking them. There's no score track. There's no points. It's just these faces. And he points out that Generation Rebbe goes, I think all this is pretty good, but I hate that. And he points at that. And he's like, so I would definitely take that out. And again, this is my first design. And one thing that I did have in my back pocket was I had created like a little Google form or a little doc of just a survey that I would send to every playtester after they played it. And I never let them put their names on it or their email addresses. They just filled it out, kept totally anonymous. So I'd always just have the comments, couldn't attribute them. And I checked them after 9 months of working on the game. I read them all in one sitting. And that was a thing that about 30-ish testers all pointed to as their favorite thing in the game. Yeah. And it was something that he identified as being something that I have to leave. If I didn't test that enough, if I hadn't been rigorous with that part of it, I might not have had the confidence in that element. But because of that, I put the players ahead of the comment of the publisher and said, you know what, I'm going to go with their instinct instead of with this publisher's. And, you know, he didn't say no about publishing that game, but he didn't give me a yes either. It was like caveats, changes, I'd like to see, things like that. Yeah. And I eventually just took it to another publisher. But I think that like sometimes, you know, early on, you need that feedback from somewhere. You need like an audience to clap. You need someone to not walk out of the room.
Yeah, absolutely.
And later on, you just kind of know a bit more when you're on the right track. And then maybe even later than that, you'll care even less about being on the right track. And that will scare some publishers. But at the same time, it's sort of a thing of like the confidence to know the thing that you're about to play is worth playing. You know, that it's like trying to find a way to kind of moderate between being self-indulgent, but too skittish to even get that out on the table. Like, I think that that's the kind of balance. And I think with music, it's very similar. Like, you see how people who don't have the courage to play out a lot, they're not getting kind of leathered up. They're not really getting beaten on enough to, like, really get that thicker skin. And I thought that, like, that's the playing out is, like, really important. And that's kind of what you're asking a designer to do when you ask them to take their idea that they can finish and then go out the door with it. You're basically telling them, could you go on tour? Can you leave town? Please leave town. Like, it's a totally different experience. You get out there and you're going to learn some things about yourself, about your music. It's good.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I wonder if, so like you had the feedback from the audience versus the publisher looking at it and going, hey, I'm not sure that the audience is going to want to see it. You know, I don't like this, but I'm also speaking as the audience that I think I need to sell this to. And it sounds like those circles just didn't have a huge overlap in the Venn diagram.
No.
That's really what that sounded like. Which is fine. Like there's all kinds of different audiences for all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
You know, some things you're going to have a broad mass audience. Some things you're going to have a niche audience, and some things, you know, different publishers have different experiences and preferences with different niche audiences.
Yeah.
Right. You know, Amabel talks about, hey, I do all these sort of weird off the wall niche things with Hollenspiel, and she absolutely does. But there's at least a half a dozen Hollenspiel games that, quite frankly, could have been really significant big box productions with a different publisher if it wasn't Amabel doing them. And that doesn't mean that it's wrong for Hollenspiel to have those. It's just that's one of the places where the audience did overlap versus, you know, the all those other weird one-off ones where the audiences didn't overlap, right? And Then She Came Back could not have been published by anybody other than Hollenspiel. There are zero other publishers out there that could have tackled that. And not just because it's Amabel's own design, but like there are no other publishers out there that would have done that justice. But like Brian Train's Shell Game or the District Commander games, there are plenty of other people out there that could have done that. So, but I think it's cool that we've got the publishers that are going to take on those niche ones and are going to be able to find and cultivate those audiences. So certainly easier now than it was 40 years ago.
I think we're going to see more. So with I'm going to get political. Sorry. With the tariffs in place, I was just going to say, I think there's going to be a lot more of this kind of DIY zine-like approach to doing a small press or small print run of games, releasing them direct to market, do limited numbers, do night markets, do stuff like that. just to kind of test the waters with what can I do with, say, printing 200 of these magazine games. In a weird way, I kind of think war games have been doing it the whole time. They just don't really build it that way. But a lot of Ziploc games and like kind of portfolio games, they're basically like the zine games.
Oh, yeah.
But the I think of in the broader industry, like outside of the historical corner, that's the place where people are not quite in that mindset. They're going to actually have to make a bigger adjustment than our corner of the hobby is going to. And I think it's really cool that the people who I think are the best poised to do this are pretty much the old grogs who've been here a long time. And then the new folks who are just getting into the hobby, they're both going to be in that spot. And some people are just going to be whining about mounted boards and other stuff. Or looking for, in the mainstream hobby, they're going to be looking for like a Calyx cube of plastic from China that isn't going to come to them. Like, it's just not going to happen. It's not a thing you can DIY back down to a manageable.
Yeah, it's the toy factor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've long had the suspicion of, and evidence continues to accumulate that I was right. And yeah, this is me bragging a little bit, but you know, I'm still right, damn it, even if I am bragging. The wargamers have been way ahead of the game industry for a long time. The problem is we're such a small niche that nobody notices. GMT was doing P500 stuff when Kickstarter's founders were in middle school, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we've been crowdfunding stuff forever. The player feedback surveys that SPI used to do forever. Like, that kind of stuff has, you know, the data-driven research from the market has been happening for the wargame companies way longer than anybody else. Campaign systems to link games together have been something that war games have done forever. Mm-hmm. Tournament play. Like, the whole point of the early conventions was to play in tournaments. And that was the standard. That's what you normally did. So all of these things that you know, the rest of the you know, big game industry, to the extent that it's a big industry, are looking around going, hey, check out this cool new thing that we've done. Really? let's back up on cool and new, first of all. Like, let's step all the way back here on cool and new. And let's maybe appreciate the fact that, you know, Dan, that DIY ethos of, hey, let's hack together our own sort of zine-like thing, mm-hmm. the low overhead, low cost to market, but rich gameplay kind of thing that we can do. Let's get that out the door. I saw there was a review not long ago of the new D&D Heroes of the Borderlands set that was, hey, it's a starter set that plays like a board game. Really? Nobody saw that coming 50 years ago. You know, let's give them a basic starter set to ease them in to something more complicated. Man, I mean, I think you're right. I think this is a place where the wargamers are going to lead, but I think it's the kind of thing wargamers have been doing for a long time and just nobody else has been paying attention.
Yeah, yeah, so, you have some good points there.
And we're not always our own best cheerleaders, right? In part because we are curmudgeons, and so people look at us and go, ah, they're just bitching again. Well, yes, we're bitching, but we're also right. You know, I mean, both things can be true.
I think there should be at least like some pride in knowing that like the rest of the hobby, like the wargamers are ahead in some places, way behind in others.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And have no places where just like all these like.
I will absolutely grant you that, Dan. I am not going to argue a bit.
I think, but like in terms of like being able to do this small, right, and being able to operate like with a smaller budget and having a sense more about like a kind of keeping your eye on the ball of like, what is this game about? What do I need to get it made? What are the bare essentials for this to get out? Versus like trying to make, you know, kind of accentuate this excessive toy factor for some of these games. And then also I laugh because it goes both ways, right? Like I see people in the hobby, like in the wargaming corner of the hobby, like they'll side-eye something when it's like looks like a toy ship on the table or something like that. Or they'll look at a game that has like a lazy Susan in the middle and they'll be like, what the hell? And other people are like literally drooling over the table. So it's just like anything else. Like I think that some of it is a little bit generational, like that the things that will boost some people and other people are going to just be like, nah, I'm cool with like my old like kind of vintage titles, or, you know, give me my CRTs, give me my, you know, hex map with the neutral tones, and I'm pretty cool with it if the game is engaging and the story it tells is really good. And I think that it's very easy for the toy factor to distract you from a really crappy story.
Yeah.
Like, and we can see, you know, again, this analogy with certain systems going on in music, that in particular, I can think of, you know, jazz. There's still a certain group of people that think if jazz is not, you know, bebop from the 50s or early 60s or something there, then it's not jazz, you know, and so much has come since then that has an improvisational component and, you know, and swings in some way or whatever, you know, that we call it jazz. And a lot of people are not open to anything outside their realm. And we see that with wargaming really bad, you know, in some aspects. That if it's not Hex Encounter, it's not a wargame, you know, but that's where the growth is going to come, is to keep fusing with other things, be it other types of games or other types of music, and new things come out of that and grow. You know, we can't get fixated on a period, or we as designers, we can't, you know. You're a player and you just like one kind of game, that's fine. You have that right.
But do you think one of the continuing threads along that line of thinking is that, you know, for example, in jazz, if there's kind of a storytelling element, like that's what people can kind of hang on to. Like the new Julian Lage record is probably going to be popular for jazz, but it's not going to be like, you know, Wes Montgomery, Nina Simone level, like kind of breakout thing. And Nina Simone, meanwhile, it's just like, I think like my nephews know who Nina Simone is. Like, it's just like, because for them, it's not jazz. It's like song. It's like almost singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
It's just songs, you know, like stories and things like that. And so I think that sometimes with these games, it's a little bit about trying to pay a little bit more attention to the story we're trying to tell, instead of just the history that we're trying to cover. And to Brandt's earlier point, when we were talking about kind of the magnetism of something like Bulge or something like Gettysburg or Waterloo, because folks know the topic. One of the things is that he's kind of mentioning is, you know, he mentioned in terms of like, that's how you can kind of show off your systems innovations and your kind of design chops, but it's also a place where you can try to get the narrative to engage in ways that are more than just the one kind of pillar. Like you know, most games that when they engage with narrative, they're doing an embedded narrative, which is just like basically like, here's some flavor text, some italicized text for you.
Oh, yeah.
And please read it in the order presented to you. They're not always evocative, like with the tension that they're making you feel, or like trying to give you certain anxieties or feelings of empowerment or achievement, different aspects of the game. And they're not always emergent. Like it's not about the player finding the story thread. It's often about them being hit in the head with the storytelling element. Because when you're telling a story that's set in a place where players are unfamiliar, you have to do all the world building and exposition. But if it's Waterloo, if it's, you know, Gettysburg, if it's Bulge, they kind of know the story beats in general. Yeah. They have some ideas.
Yeah. The way I've heard the sort of the flavor text piece that, you know, hey, please read this, but it doesn't matter for the purpose of the game. They're dressed up flashcards, right? It's, you know, it's things you might want to know, but you don't have to know to play the game. And so it's just those are the flashcards versus the experience of being in the shoes of the decision makers in the moment and having to go through the same cognitive processes that the people did in the moment in the situations you're putting them in. I can memorize flashcards all day, but that doesn't tell me what it was like to be there and to be in those shoes and having to make those decisions.
Yeah, with, you know, when I use flavor text, it's almost like to explain why does this card exist? Here's what you get to do. Here's the rule you get to break. Here's the thing like that. And then I say, okay, because such and such happened and this person was involved. And you don't have to read it to play the game. But for historical gamers, you know, I think they're more interested in the history. So, you know, than non-historical gamers. And so they will pay attention to it. But for other people, it's for nothing. That's how I do incorporate that in some. The Confederate raid on St. Albans, if you don't know that story, it's like one of the most amazing stories, you know, from start to finish, from planning the raid all the way through the last trial. And, you know, there's so much going on in there. It's very interesting. And that's
I don't want you to give away the game, but how the hell did the Confederates get to Vermont?
See, that's your first question. You should be asking when you see the name of the game, right? But actually, they think about 20,000 Confederate POWs in the North escaped and or bribed their way out of prisons. And so it was easiest for them to cross the border into Canada. So they particularly grouped around Montreal, which had a pretty big Southern, sympathy, and some in Toronto and things. And when the Confederate Secret Service figured out, we got all these soldiers up there and they can't get back home, but we got to do something with them. So they said, let's do a series of raids on border towns and into New England and force more Union troops to be shifted up north. And they only did one. And they went into St. Albans, Vermont, 20 miles south of the border, and they tried to set fire to the town. And they used a Canadian chemist to make their Greek fire, and he didn't do a good job, and it was raining, so that didn't work at all. But they did steal, in today's money, $4 million out of three banks.
Wow.
And that was a lot of money. And that was part of their mission, too, was to steal money to take back for the Confederacy and all this kind of stuff, too. So it didn't happen until October of 64. And so by then, fate was fairly well sealed. But that was their...
It started out as the firebombing of Dresden and ended up as Kelly's Heroes.
Yeah, yeah. anyway, but it involved a chase back to Vermont, to Canada, and two trials where the Confederates bribed the first judge to let everybody go. But then the British said, no, we got to get them back. And spies that had to go get documents to show that it was a Confederate mission and they just weren't, thieves and murderers. So it's, and all that ends up in the game. But I'm really excited for that one to come out. It's a little different too. And you move man to man. And
I am now. I mean, yeah.
But that's you're so right. And the story is everything to me anymore. If I find a tale that I think has to be told, and I'm still trying to figure out how to even begin to tell a few tales that I think should be told. But that's where I start now. And it's not necessarily where I first did, but that's the thing. And I'm very fortunate. I've convinced Mari Suckling to work with me on a game, and he teaches this at the college level,
Yeah.
And so he's really fantastic to work with. And I'm, learning, even though we just sort of got started, I'm learning so much through him too. And that's what I'm doing this for too, is, to express myself, to see the games out there I want, and to learn. I'm just learning so much in this time, which if I'd done just music, I'd be getting, stronger and better in that. I would hope. At some point, it'll probably reverse at some age. But at this point, it's been fun to deep dive into something totally different that's very similar,
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right. So when's the game show up? Come on. Maurice Suckling's a good dude to work with, too. I mean, the guy's literally written a book on game design. So, I mean,
that's... Yeah, exactly. It's just a super nice guy, too, And I can tell you what that's on if you want to know. We haven't said we won't tell, but it's on what the book in the first movie called The Japan's Longest Day. Okay. And does that give you an idea what it could be? I'm curious.
I have to think about it for a second.
Yeah, but it's a...
We'll let Dan answer, too.
I only watch four movies. I'm very sorry to disappoint.
Well, I don't know if we're going to call the game that or not, but it's... The actual day is the day leading up to the radio address from Hirohito that they're surrendering. But there were a lot of politics going back and forth as to would they decide to surrender. And Maurice is tackling that subject. And then I have the second part of the game, which actually happened. An army coup happened against the emperor.
Yeah.
And so that's what it was about. Now,
were they going to depose him? Were they going to let him surrender? Were they going to convince the allies to leave him in place and have a conditional surrender versus unconditional surrender?
This is actually to not surrender at all. There's, in this game, there's two factions. The peace faction, which Hirohito and, his cabinet were in favor of, and the prime minister, Suzuki in particular. And then certain army officers were more or less, some were said, well, the emperor said it, we got to do it, and that loyalty thing. But then there was the honor faction that said, no, this is not right. This is not honorable. So we're going to do a coup. And that's what, having a lot of fun putting all this together. I see where he's going with his half, and I'm excited about my half and stuff too. So we'll see.
Let's go.
So Dan, what's next on your drafting table over there? Are you allowed to say?
Yeah, actually, in January, I'm going to self-publish another game under the Lockhorns. LLC. It's going to be another small print run, so I'm only going to do 200. I'm only selling them in the U.S. It's a game called Penitent, and it's about Quaker penal reform in the 19th century.
Oh, wow.
Designed a penitentiary, solitaire game, and then you are going to see how your bold experiment fares well, whether you go along with the silent system or you adopt a separate system. So it's kind of the Auburn, Pennsylvania school app. So I think the way I build it on social media was Galaxy Trucker meets Foucault's Discipline and Punish. So,
okay, so now you're back to what the record companies do, which is I'm going to compare it to something people already know in the hopes of attracting part of that audience.
Definitely.
So
I learned something, I guess.
There's a good dude who works in the business. I've referenced him a couple times on podcasts over the years. There's a guy named Jeff Tidbull who he's up in Minneapolis. He now runs Left Justified Studios, which is his own company. But he spent a bunch of years working for Atlas Games. And he's basically around my age, a little younger, but he's basically been in the game business aside from a couple years in film school. He's been in the game business since high school. And so there's guy's been around a long time, done a lot of interesting things as a part of it. But he's also taught some game design at both the college and high school level, some informal classes, some of them just as kind of, you know, the after school workshop sort of thing. But one of the things that he always comes back to is that elevator pitch for your game. And this doesn't apply as much to historicals where we're weaving that narrative around a specific event somehow, but for games much broader and much more in general, it's a game where you do X by Y. You score points by laying tiles and laying claim to them with pieces. It's a game where you take tricks by playing cards with, you know, matching or not matching suits. It's a game where you, you know, control routes on a map by playing cards to lay trains or whatever. And so you should be able to describe your underlying game as it's a game where you do X by Y. And this is what you want to do and how you do it. And it's always been something that I've come back to whenever I'm talking with folks more broadly about the game business. But Wes, to your point earlier about the narrative piece, I think that comparison really starts to break down when you dig into significant historical topics, because it's not just a single X by Y sort of thing. There are multiple mechanics, multiple processes you have to juggle in order to fully capture the dynamics of those decisions that tell the story.
Yeah.
I just, you know, you're right on St. Albans. I don't know that you would capture that as this is a game where you do X by Y.
No.
Dan, I don't know that your Penitent game, just from the general sounds of it, that is something that can be encapsulated that succinctly. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's one of the strengths of the historical narratives that we weave into a lot of our games.
Maybe our fellow designers should become better at misrepresenting their games. Doing it in a more pithy, kind of quick way, and then just kind of talking around what the game's about, but just leaving a little interesting morsel in there where they still want to know. They still
Yeah. I mean, if you think of going to GMT or Compass or any of them, and you said something that was described your game in that short of a degree, they're just not going to have any idea, and they're either just going to dismiss you, what are you talking about, or maybe they'll ask you to hear a little bit more. But that wouldn't be the cool way, I think, to pitch a game to companies like that. Maybe I'm wrong, and they'll be, you know, calling up and saying, no, do it that way. But I just can't imagine that.
I think there's a 0% chance that anybody at Compass is listening to this podcast. I think we're pretty safe there. There may be some stray GMT-connected people or GMT-adjacent people that are giving us a listen, but I'm not counting on anybody from Compass giving us a –
Well, you got to, do you know, too, there are some other musicians in the, this whole gang of game companies and stuff. Denver has guitar, you know, degree. She's graduated.
She's got a doctorate.
Yeah, she's very good. And Grant, you know, he loves the rock band he's playing with. He plays rock guitar in Worthington, from Worthington.
I did not know that about Grant.
Yes. Oh, yeah. In fact, I keep telling them every time at PressCon, I say, just give me a call. We'll put together a band. Let's play a few songs. Sort of a nice moment for a bunch of companies to come together on something. And Dan Pancaldi.
Dan's done a ton of stuff.
You can look him up on YouTube, and he was world class on marimba, man. He really was.
Yeah. At the risk of embarrassing her if she ever listens to this, I've known Denver since she was in high school.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Because because when Mark Walker first launched Lock and Load Publishing before he later sold it to David Heath and then started his new companies. But when Mark Walker first launched Lock and Load Publishing, we split the booth with him at Origins in 2007. We had Bayonet Games in one half of the booth and Lock and Load was sharing booth space with us. And Mark and Janice brought all three of the girls. And I think that was Denver's senior year of high school, or she had just graduated.
Oh, wow.
But then she had her two younger sisters with them also. And so, you know, I've known them that long, and they've been wonderful people. I mean, they're great folks. But yeah, you know, seeing Denver now, like, you know, married, running the company for Mark more than, you know, more often than not. And it's, you know, again, it's like, wait a minute, I remember you when, you know, it's just sort of it's one of those, oh God, I'm old kind of moments.
I'll say that.
Don't worry, Dan, they're coming.
I know they're coming.
Look, I gave Denver one of them this past summer when she stopped by our space, because again, going back that long, when she met my son, he was 4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's engaged. Okay. Guys, we're a little over an hour as we're recording this. Again, you know, with some light editing, we'll probably come in pretty close to around an hour. You know, this was something that kind of started as an offhanded remark in the discussion. I think it was around the Insurgent Catan game that came out of the Naval Postgraduate School some number of years ago is where this whole thing started. But the, you know, when I wanted to revisit the topic, it was sort of, all right, who do I know that's been both the wargaming space and knows the music business some? And that's where the two of y'all came up into the conversation. It's like, all right, let me go see who I can grab. And you guys both said yes first. So thank you. definitely appreciate it. But as we wind this down, with that as a bit of a thought, Wes, I'll throw it to you first, and then we'll let Dan wrap it up. But are there any other thoughts or anything else that's occurred to you as a part of all of this in terms of those similarities where the wargaming, but game publishing really as a whole, with wargaming as our preferred niche of it, kind of overlaps with the music business, something we hadn't already hit or something that we did that you may want to just reinforce?
Not so much from what I said, but I know you kept trying to bring it back to a higher level, and the mergers going on with the game companies, and the same thing happened with the music companies. And it's very interesting what sort of pulled the rug out from underneath, you know, all the big companies, or so many of them, was, you know, streaming and this sort of thing. So there's more, you know, what's analogous to that is maybe print and play. And that does seem to be getting more and more popular. But, you know, if you're still somebody like me, all right, and this is part of my age, I want my games around me and not have to be, you know, into trying to make them and all that kind of stuff. But streaming, I have 600 music DVDs. I'm not getting rid of them. You know? Yeah. 300 World War II movies, you know, too. So maybe I'm going to not a good person to talk to about all that, you know, about the implications of all that changing and so much changing. But I think what Dan said about the do-it-yourself kind of thing mentality, that's going to get bigger and bigger, because you can, and you can, you know, do things like Kickstarter. You can do something more on your own, and you have YouTube to promote, and you have so many ways to do it. So, yeah, so, you know, maybe where we're headed is a bunch of smaller companies that just work at their own pace, you know, not trying to conquer the world, but just offer something to it. And, you know, I like what you're doing, Dan. You said you're getting your own. Do you use a U.S. printer when you do 200 copies of a game?
Yeah.
And you
I
have
actually use three vendors to make them, source them, the different things, and then I assemble here and then ship them out.
Okay.
It's a great feeling, though, to send your files away and then have the game in your house in 4 weeks. I fulfilled the last Kickstarter in 8 weeks. It was like,
wow.
I think that's so slick to be able to get everything, send them out. People aren't waiting a long time. So when they order, they just know they're going to get it, like, soon. And I just think that quick turnaround for fulfillment, the low print copies make that possible. You know, to actually. Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of companies you need to have a conversation with when you're fulfilling Kickstarters within 8 weeks, and we've got some that are going on 4 years.
Hey, Warcraft, our goal always is to have our all the files ready to go. So as soon as we get the money, they're going off, and so we're going to get them back within a few months. You know, interesting though, just from what we were saying, it just hit me, and it happened to be next to me. I went ahead and ordered this game.
Yeah.
You know about it?
So it's, it's for the audio only audience. It's the Battlefields of the Napoleon. Wes is holding it up to the camera as though we're recording the video, which we're not. So
designed by Paolo Mori. It is excellent. That is probably my favorite release so far.
Yeah. And so it's his, he's got his own little company, and this is what you're getting. I mean, this is not fancy. This great designer who's designed so many games that sell so many copies, it's one of these. Yeah. It's a brown box, and you open it up, and you know, like something like what Worthington did at first, you know.
Yeah, Worthington did that. Columbia has done that forever, where it's it's a folded brown box, almost like a mailing box with the paper sleeve around it that looks like a standard GMT or Compass style box cover.
So, I think is the company, and there were like around 500-ish copies.
Yeah.
It's not big. I mean, it's big for an indie release, but it's certainly not, you know, industry shaking kind of big.
But he's an example, and who knows, maybe he's a musician, we don't know it, but this is an example of, you know, he could go get a deal with somebody with that game, and but it's going to be some years before it comes out and all that. He said, I'm going to just move on it on my own, you know, and I think, you know, who knows, we might all be there in one way or another after a while, but we still have games that are being, you know, produced by other companies too. So you're just saying, where is it going? Maybe that's where it's going a little bit. So
yeah, I think the print on demand has certainly changed a lot of the ability of people to do those smaller, more independent, follow your muse kinds of things. Dan has been able to source things from some publisher, some manufacturing facilities willing to take on smaller print runs. Somebody like Blue Panther that, you know, doesn't even hit print on the Dr. Seuss machine until somebody places the order. You know, that, and we use Blue Panther and Steve as kind of the avatar for, there are a couple of different companies that do the same thing Steve does. He's just the famous one. To the extent that anybody
does it very well, too. He does it very well.
Oh, yeah. He does a fantastic job of it. And he's a hilarious dude to hang out and have a beer with. So it's a bonus. But he, you know, if those kinds of things had existed 20 years ago when I was still pretending to be a publisher, things might have gone very different back then. That wasn't an avenue that was open at the time. And so, you know, things didn't go that way. They went a different way. But, you know, for Dan, for you to be able to find a, you know, couple of vendors that are willing to provide you 200, quite frankly, is a very low quantity of any kind of print run. But that they're willing to do that for you. And then you've got the, you know, the initiative and the gumption and the wherewithal to want to go out and do all that to get your thing out there. That's really cool. I mean, it's a lot like folks, you know, sort of stuffing tapes and mailers to send them out to the fan club, you know. It's that same thing. So guys, this has been cool, this has been fun. It's a direction we don't often go here on the podcast, where we end up talking music at all, and I have a feeling if all we did was just sit here and talk music, we'd have a 9-hour podcast. But yeah, I hope the audience has gotten something interesting out of this that's a little off the beaten path. Please chime in with your thoughts, your comments, your reactions, either directly below this on the podcast episode, or, you know, hop in our forums, or just sound off on the socials. Just make sure you tag us so we know that it was out there. And you know, we'd love to hear your thoughts on where these comparisons went. But also, I would be interested in, you know, I wanted to keep bringing it back to comparisons between the music business and game publishing and the wargaming business. But if you've got other industries, businesses, you know, markets that you think the game industry kind of ties into, maybe a little better, maybe a little worse, you know, let us know. Hey, I think it's actually more like this other thing, and here are the comparison points, and here's why I think that. I'd be interested to see, because there's a lot of things that I don't know about how those other kinds of markets work. I've been a little bit about the music business, and so I grab people that know more than me to compare it with. Guys, it's cool. Thank you very much. Audience, thank you all very much. We will catch you next time on another episode of Mention and Dispatch.